Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the second of our interviews with Elizabeth Chadwick. This week, Elizabeth gives her insights about Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Okay, so I'm here with Elizabeth Chadwick. We've spoken before about William Marshall, but of course you've written a lot about Eleanor of Aquitaine as well, haven't you? So I'm going to ask you some of the same questions, actually.
That's fine.
Compare it. Why Eleanor?
Well, this will be the same answer, some of it, and as I gave to William Marshall, in that you can't write about the 12th century without coming across Eleanor of Aquitaine. Yeah. And you wonder about her. What was she really like? Who are you? And again, what can you tell me that you've not told anyone before? Boy, did she tell me a lot.
Yeah.
So then I start researching, and the more I research, the more interested I become, and the more curious, and the more I want to dig. So that's why Eleanor.
Right.
It's my personal nosiness.
So Eleanor is very interesting to me because it seems there are an awful lot of myths, both contemporary with her and more recent.
Yeah.
Did you have any of those in your mind when you started?
When I started, well, I think I got them in my mind because I sort of read some of her biographies, and I knew the ones such as the her supposed affair with her uncle in Antioch, and of course this whole line in winter relationship with Henry II. But there were other things. What began to make me wonder about what I'd been fed, if you like, was I thought, well, I wonder what Eleanor looks like. And having read novels, and even in earlier novels myself, thinking of her as having this long, dark hair, I thought, well, if I'm going to write a full, proper novel about her, I need to know what she looked like. So I went to look, and there are no contemporary descriptions of Eleanor whatsoever, none. There are a couple of depictions. One is on her tomb, which doesn't show her hair or anything. There's a church window, which again just shows some nice clothes. There's a psalter, which shows a grey-haired lady, which is in debate as to whether it's Eleanor or not. But I went to those biographies to have a look at what they said. This is supposedly factual information about Eleanor. One of them said that she was black-eyed Eleanor. This was W.L. Warren, who's generally quite a respected historian.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
No source.
Right.
Another one said, went on, she was a black-eyed beauty with a curvaceous figure that never ran to fat in old age. No source. Another one, I think it was Marion Mead, had her as a saucy, hot-blooded, blue-eyed blonde. So here we've got a black-haired, black-eyed, we've got a blue-eyed blonde, no source. Alison Weir had her as a green-eyed redhead.
There is that picture, is it there? There's a picture on a wall with her.
Is she not, but it's not her.
Right.
That's another of the myths that goes with her. It's a man.
Right.
It's probably the young king. Because it's got a shoulder pin, a cloak pinned upon the shoulder. And no woman ever dresses like that, ever. It's a male cultural dress. Right. I've been researching it in detail.
Okay. I'm going to have to change my logo then.
Yes.
That's fine.
it's like the Queen turning up in a man's suit to a gig. That's how different it is.
Yeah.
So there's all these different supposedly factual impressions
all
of Eleanor. All unsupported.
Yeah.
The only thing that might support her being a blonde is that she had a relative back in the 11th century called William the Towhead. So that was fascinating. So I realised that the biographies, half the time, were making it up as they went along.
Yeah.
The other thing was that the biographies and some historians said that Eleanor got a half-brother called Jocelyn.
Right.
And I thought, oh, well, if I'm writing a novel, I've got to know about it. Because apparently he was so important to her that she gave him some land in Sussex at Petworth. And Alison Weir said, it's mentioned in the pipe rolls. So off I went to the pipe rolls, which are books of accounts for the period, which, and there, sure enough, was Jocelyn, brother of the Queen, given so much land at Petworth. Trouble is, it doesn't say which Queen. It turns out to be Queen Adeliza of Louvain, second Queen of Henry I, who had a half-brother called Jocelyn and gave him land at Petworth. And then he went on and married one of the Percys and started the Percy family. So it's nothing to do with Eleanor of Aquitaine. And yet there it is, solid in the history books, along with her hair colour.
Yeah.
And it's wrong.
Yes.
So it's me asking, who are you? Yeah. Who were you? And how am I going to find out? Because the biography sure as heck don't know. you know.
Yes, I think we were just talking a moment ago, weren't we? That we want to be a particular kind of person.
Exactly.
And I guess that's the same now in wanting her to be a sort of a powerful, independent, autonomous woman. In the past, also they also projected their own prejudices on her, didn't they?
They
She's
did.
Had this all the way through her life and history.
That's very true. I would definitely recommend a book, actually, by a man called Michael Evans, called Inventing Eleanor.
Okay,
which looks at how the legends have come about, and in his own words, he says, I'm paraphrasing, but how she has become very, very different to the 12th century queen she was, because we've put so much detritus on her.
Yeah.
There's the legends from her own time about her having affairs with various people to blacken the Angevin family name. Then there are the ballads written in the 17th century for entertainment, where she went out and poisoned Rosamund de Clifford and had an affair with William Marshall and had his child, which is patently impossible because apparently in this ballad, William Marshall takes her virginity, but seeing William Marshall wasn't born until she'd been married for at least 10 years to the King of France, it can't have been.
She had an affair in one with Saladin, didn't she?
Oh, yes, that was another one. Yes, that's right, yes. So she's telling all these affairs, she's... And then she gets, the Stricklands get hold of her and have her bombing about the Holy Land with one breast exposed.
Yeah.
And that's all been debunked now. Then there's Amy Kelly's Courts of Love, where she was supposedly sitting with her daughter, judging men for lovers' crimes. In Aquitaine in 1168, which never happened either. And then you get Catherine Hepburn doing the Fall Lion in Winter thing.
Ah, but surely, come on, that's got to be right. You're trying to tell me Catherine Hepburn was not a...
No, I have to leave the room if Catherine Hepburn comes on. I cannot stand that film. It's Catherine Hepburn being Catherine Hepburn.
Yes, and indeed Peter O'Toole being Peter O'Toole.
But I do love The Devil's Crown. You can find it on YouTube. It's the BBC from the 1970s, starring Jane Lapater as Eleanor Aquitaine, and Jane Lapater is spot on.
Right, okay. I'll look that up. So,
yes. In fact, Jane Lapater wrote to me and said she'd really loved my Eleanor of Aquitaine novels.
Really good.
Out of the blue.
Yeah,
so I thought, well, I loved your Eleanor of Aquitaine. So...
superb.
But it, like or loathe Catherine Hepburn's performance, and most people love it, I know I'm an exception, she's part of the inventing Eleanor that's gone on. We see her as this sort of kick-ass feminist. Everybody says, oh, she was ahead of her time. She wasn't. She was of her time.
Yeah.
She was a fascinating, interesting woman who had tremendous stamina and tremendous emotional resilience, but she was still a woman of her time. And the amount of power she wielded was very much dependent on men.
Right.
Either on husbands who didn't let her have any or locked her up, or on a son who gave her authority during his absence. And when he returned, she retired to a monk at a convent.
Right. So let's start off. Fine, great. That's setting the standard, isn't it? So, and we don't know much about her childhood, do we? But she ends up as being quite a prize, if that's the right word to use.
Yes. One of the childhood things, again, that's been in debate, but now looks to be really coming down on the side of, is that she was married at the age of 13 to Louis, Prince of France, when her father passed away. She was heir to Aquitaine. And Louis's father died soon after that, so by the summer of that year of being 13 years old, she was Queen of France. But she's 13 years old.
Yeah.
Now, the age of majority then was 12.
Yeah.
But even so, when you think of a 13-year-old girl versus middle-aged politicians, ecclesiasts and the lot, 13-year-old girls are not going to be ruling France. She might have an effect on her young husband, who's only 17. They're a pair of teenagers together. But they're not exactly going to be dominating the political arena.
Louis VII gets a rather bad press, it always seems to me. What do you think that relationship was like? What do we know about that?
Well, people to say about that he was infatuated and passionate about Eleanor, but at the same time that he was monkish. So you've got complete opposites there. But I think they were different aspects, different parts of his life, I think, that people change. We tend to sometimes see people as being static when they're not. I think that he was quite passionate about her, but he had been destined for the church, so he got a conflict going on between religion, you know, versus this secular life. He was known, and Abbot Suger comments on it, that he had a terrible temper, and we have backup of that where someone rebelled against him, and he took a sword and chopped off their hands and feet. He also burned an entire village in Vitry inside their church. But I think that was perhaps a watershed for him and turned him perhaps towards the religious side. And it was like, oh, no, what have I done? Perhaps turned him into more a monk. I mean, Eleanor's supposed to have said, I married a monk.
Right.
I do suspect, though this is a theory and it's not proven, but I do suspect that in the end, Louis had trouble on with the bedroom side of things unless it was really big time sanctioned by the church.
Right.
So every time you find a child being born, if you click back 9 months earlier, you find a big religious ceremony.
Right.
I've ended up counting on my fingers.
Is that right? Okay.
Seriously. Eleanor and he implored the church for a child, and she'd given him a beautiful vase. You can now see it in the Louvre. Yes. It's been tarted up a bit by Abbot Suger, but the middle of it's very much as Eleanor presented it to Louis as a wedding gift. They gave that vase to the church and in supplication for a child.
Right.
And so there was obviously some sort of ceremony going on, this vase giving. And 9 months later, Eleanor has a daughter.
Interesting.
They go on crusade. They come back. Their marriage is in trouble, but the Pope says, oh, come on, have a kiss and make up, and here's a lovely bed, and I'll bless it for you.
Right.
9 months later, she has a second daughter. And then, of course, she went off with Henry. Louis gets married, so he's having marriage ceremony, bedding ceremony. 9 months later, he has a daughter.
Right.
And then he has another daughter. I'm not quite sure what happened with that one. It must have been her churching ceremony, because the child born more or less straight on the heel of the next one. So, churching ceremony. Right. And a little later than that, Thomas Becket gets exiled. He goes to France. We know he blesses Louis. And 9 months later, comes the son, Philip, who's called the God-given.
Yes. So it's a great theory, doesn't it? It sounds like you've convinced me.
It's really quite strong. It's striking when you look at the timing and you count back 9 months every time.
Well, I understand that if you did everything the church told you to do, then you could have sex on 52 days of the year.
Something like that. It wasn't very often.
No.
So Eleanor was always up against it for producing a son.
Right.
Because she'd have to sort of get some big ceremony going. And of course, on crusade, Louis very possibly took vows of chastity. Yeah. So
when Eleanor got to court at the age of 13, do you think she faced a very different situation?
I think she had a lot of difficulties because she got a strong mother-in-law who in her lifetime witnessed many, many more charters than Eleanor ever did. Mm. So she was a player who Eleanor had to face and deal with. Mm. She got Bernard of Clairvaux, possibly writing things about her, you know, without actually naming her. Mm. And she got her sister Petronella, who got into terrible trouble for having an affair with a married man, and Eleanor sorted them out a marriage, which ended up causing all kinds of trouble.
So she intervenes then in that situation.
She intervenes
On
behalf of her sister. So that's like a personal domestic situation that then went badly pear-shaped and caused a lot of trouble. I don't think that politically she had a lot of say as queen when she was Queen of France. I think politically all the time she was on the back foot.
Right. One of the things that always astounded me was that they get divorced.
Well, there were no male heirs, and the King of France, you have to have a male heir.
Right.
So I think that was a big part of it. I don't think Eleanor was happy in the marriage either, because there was all this. While they were on crusade, she asked Louis for an annulment, and Abbé Suger sort of broke from France and said no, because he could see the land disappearing.
Yeah,
I think she was ready to get out of the marriage. Definitely, I think that was perhaps one of the reasons in Antioch. I mean, there's the claim that she had an affair with her uncle, but that's I don't think that's a starter at all. But he was her uncle, and so he was, if you like, head of the family, even though not actually the Duke of Aquitaine or anything. He was like a male head of her family who she could look to for succour. So it's like, I will stop with you and Louis can go off on his own. And I'm here safe with a male relative. But Louis wasn't having any of that. And, you know, more or less tied her up and forced her to come with him. So I think that's partly what that was about. Eleanor was determined to have a divorce. It didn't happen. And then the Pope obviously bound them more closely together. And the marriage just kept on going rotten once they got home. And they did get an annulment. But yes, I think with Louis, it was, well, I've got two girls and this wife who hates me.
Yes. But Eleanor...
or dislikes me.
Yeah. So Eleanor had, although the reason may well be a good traditional one, that they needed a son, Eleanor is an agent in that.
I think she's an agent in that.
Yeah.
But I don't think she would have got the annulment without Louis's consent. It was still Louis's end prerogative to actually choose to do it.
Yes. So we have this separation then, which is quite dramatic, isn't it?
Mm. They had meetings to decide who got what and to agree the withdrawal process. But then Eleanor headed off back to Aquitaine and was nearly abducted by a couple of people, Theobald of Blois, who thought that she might make a tasty wife.
Yeah.
Because she was still only in her mid to late 20s at that stage.
Yeah.
And also Henry II's brother, Geoffrey, also tried to abduct her, but she managed to evade them both. She married Henry II, well, he wasn't Henry II at the time, but Henry, the young Duke of Normandy, soon after coming home to Aquitaine. Well, it was obvious that she couldn't remain alone for long because all the vultures were circling to get her. She had to marry someone pretty damn fast. And Henry had been at court while the divorce was being negotiated. What isn't always noted was that when Henry came to court during the time of the divorce negotiation, he'd come for other purposes, was that his father was with him, Geoffrey le Bel. Now, his father was only 38, and who's head of the family there? Who tried to get a marriage with Henry to Louis and Eleanor's daughter Marie a few years earlier?
Right.
So who wants to get Aquitaine into the family?
Yes.
You know.
It's Geoffrey.
So often you will see it in the biographies and everything. Yeah. Did Henry and... Eleanor, get it together. Yes. Did they do this? Were they passionate then? And I'm thinking, well, there's another man involved here.
More likely to be Geoffrey.
I think there's a strong possibility that Geoffrey is involved in this. He's head of the family.
Yeah.
He knows the divorce is going through. He knows that Aquitaine would be a nice little package in with the rest of it.
And there is a rumour at the time, isn't there, that Geoffrey and
Eleanor were supposed to have had an affair. That's another of those things. I don't think that's true at all, but... He supposedly warned Henry off her. Mm. I don't think he did that at all because I think it was Gerald of Wales who said it.
Who's
a pinch of salt, yes. On the basis of no smoke without fire, I think that possibly he took Henry to one side and said, "Look, she's 9 years older. I married a woman 9 years older, and you have to be so careful with them because you know that they'll take the bit between the teeth if you let them. You know, look at my marriage to your mother Matilda. Right. You know, just be careful."
I have an idea
that he probably gave advice because his own marriage had been so similar.
Yeah.
In that respect.
Because the Empress Matilda famously...
Yes, an older woman above his own rank.
Mm.
And at this point, Henry's Duke of Normandy and she's Queen of France. She's got all of Aquitaine. So there's an older woman above his rank.
Right.
So I have a strong suspicion. And I think that because Geoffrey then went and got a chill and died very shortly after, I think he just gets shoved into the side and nobody ever thinks who else was there at the court. Yeah.
But they do get married, Eleanor and Henry.
Yes.
And obviously they have a very long career together. Tell me something about what happens, what your view about that first period of their marriage until, you know, the 1173-74 rebellion.
I think they probably got on pretty well at the outset. I think Henry was... They were probably both attracted to each other. They had various things to do in common. They were still young enough to be flexible. And I think Henry was, as a young man, flexible, joyful, outgoing. I think it just all got hardened and gnarled and nasty when he got older, especially when his children grew up and started vying for that power. Mm. But here he is, he's a young man on the up on fortune's wheel. And so I think at the outset they made a really good fist of it. I mean, he did leave Eleanor in as regent with help in England in those early years, and she was busy producing children, one a year or every other year at the outset. So they were being pretty prolific in that department. Yeah.
So you think Eleanor would be, what sort of role do you think she would have had then?
I think she would have had a diplomatic role, because the Queen as meter, greeter and peacemaker is a vitally important role of medieval queens. Mm. And also the kinship and connection bonds that they can bring together. And a little bit of child raising on the side, because although there were royal nurses and everything, up to the age of seven the children would have been in the household and she'd have had bits of childcare to do. Mm. Not the feeding and wiping, but of that bit of educating, I think. And also she was doing a bit of regency stuff when he was away in those early years. He left her with other advisers, so she wasn't regent on her own, but there were executive decisions, chairman of the board decisions to be taken.
So she's involved.
So she's involved at that stage.
In 1158, I think they invade Toulouse. Do you think that's got anything to do with Eleanor?
I initially thought it did, because I always thought it was part of the land that she'd always felt that she'd had. I mean, Louis had had a bash at it, and now Henry. So that suggests that Eleanor might have had notions of Henry going into Toulouse and getting this land back for her. But to be honest, I'm still not quite sure about it. Mm. So that's sort of sitting on the fence, thinking, yes, no. I put yes in my novels, but I'm open to
Henry's capable of invading Toulouse all by himself.
I think so. I think there are perhaps other issues going on, but not the ones that I've explored enough to be able to talk about in detail. I do think with Henry and Eleanor that Henry was an alpha male, always an alpha male, so he's always going to be the one in charge. Definitely, he's got a wife who's 9 years older than he is. A woman of the world, and in fact, a woman who was dealing with his own father in woman of the world terms while he was still sucking his comfort blanket. Mm-hmm. So she was of his father's, if you like, generation, and she'd been to the Holy Land. She got life experience way ahead of his. So I think he was wary of her, because, you know, she's this step above. Mm. Which I think is also the reason why Henry always had very young mistresses. They're all young teenagers. Right. Who aren't going to challenge him. You know, it's a complete pattern.
Yeah. So the implication is that Eleanor was challenging him. She had her own voice.
She had her... I don't know. No, the implication is that he thought she might challenge him.
Right.
You know, and she might do. She would be a woman who wouldn't just sit there and go, yes, Henry. She'd go, but don't you think? Or what about that? Yeah. I think we ought to do this. And he'd be like, I'm not sure about that. You know. So...
She
wasn't a yes woman.
So, and then she spent some time back in Aquitaine, doesn't she?
Yeah.
1168.
1168, she went back to Aquitaine, yes. But she went with Henry's governor, Patrick of Salisbury. She had Henry's men round her, as it were. I don't know whether this was a form of separation, because she by now had her last child. Mm. John, born in 1166. So perhaps there was some form of separation, I don't know. But the amount of land they had was so great that someone had to be somewhere always.
How much political control do you think she had at that stage in Aquitaine?
I don't think she had that much political control. I think Henry had the reins. Mm. I think that's probably part of what the rebellion was about.
Right.
When we come up to the 1170s, I think that was one of the catalysts. Mm. I think the final straw was that I think it was the Count of Toulouse came to do homage to the Angevin family, as it were, and did homage for to Henry, and didn't do homage to Eleanor.
Right.
And I think she felt that she was being undermined. I think that was probably the last straw in a lot of straws that we perhaps don't know all of them, but it was that undermining of, I'm the Duchess of Aquitaine, why is he, and hit the Count of Toulouse being an old enemy, why is he not bowing to me, why is he bowing to you, you know, how dare you, and by him not acknowledging her, it means that Aquitaine is going even more into Henry's pocket.
Yeah.
And I think, the rebellion of the sons was over Henry taking land from, or castles from his eldest son and handing them over to John, who was still a child, as part of John's marriage settlement. And it was the young king going, you can't do that. You know, what about me? You've given me nothing. And I think with Eleanor, with her sons and that rebellion, I think it was like, I have a choice. I have my husband and the past and what he's doing and what he's doing, or I have my sons who are my flesh and they are the future. Mm. So who am I going to support?
I would come to that, and it would be really interesting to talk about the dynamic. Before going to that, do you have any impression, I guess it's very difficult to know, but what her attachment was to Aquitaine? Very often people paint it as, you know, kind of emotional attachment between her and land, or her and people of Aquitaine that she never quite lost. Do you think that's true, or do you think that's, you know?
To be honest, I don't know. She was very peripatetic in her lifetime. But it is her childhood roots, the home of her childhood. So there must be that, I think, must be the definitely that connection there. Political rule there, she's never really had any when you look at it at all, because she left it when she was 13. But she has those 13 years with family, with parents, with grandparents. So I think there must be some emotional connection there.
And these families were all still the same families, weren't they, in Aquitaine? Mm. And they're all families that her father and her grandfather dealt with.
So I think there must be some emotional connection there. But like everybody, it is open to that speculation. Yeah. You can't really... there's not really that much written about it.
Nothing survives. So then, as you say, we get to this big moment where she decides to side with her sons in rebellion against Henry
II. Yes.
Why do you think she does that?
And I think it's because she probably thought Henry was being unfair, and she was being basically undermined in her own lands. Even if she hadn't had that much of a say in her own lands, to see that blatant undermining is probably one of the catalysts. Mm. Her sons were growing up. Her eldest son and heir, young Henry, he was married. He got a household, and yet his father was now taking his castles away and handing them over to his youngest son. Mm. And I think she would probably have seen that as being very wrong as well. And I also think perhaps she had no choice. She was, you know, stuck in between two grindstones. Mm-hmm. She had to choose which way to jump, to Henry or to her sons. Her sons were born of her body, and they were the future. Mm-hmm. And so you go for the future and not the past.
I was wondering if they'd won, and they weren't that far away from they'd have done with Henry II, Henry himself.
I wonder. I do wonder what they would have done with Dad.
Put him in a castle.
Whether they'd have shut him up at Old Sarum, but I suspect not. He probably would have had to die somehow.
Yeah.
Very possibly.
Yeah, sort of Richard II situation, maybe. Yes. But of course, he doesn't lose, he wins. What impact does that have on Eleanor's life?
Eleanor was supposedly caught fleeing to the French court, disguised as a man. Only one chronicler says this, don't know if it's true or not. Hmm. I mean, it could be just the chronicler because Eleanor was behaving in a non-womanly way. Right. That he dressed her in male clothes just to add further opprobrium to her, you know. So, but whatever happened, she was apprehended on her way to the French court and imprisoned, kept under house arrest, and eventually under house arrest at Old Sarum, and guarded quite closely for a while.
Do we know of anything of her life during that?
But the pipe rolls do say that later on she was allowed a saddle, was a saddle provided, and clothes and robes. This was later on, about 7 or 8 years into it, I think. So she was allowed to go out riding and things like that. But it seems at the outset that she was kept under fairly close house arrest. Having said that, I think the young king would have come to visit her because he had permission to build a mews for his hawks. So perhaps he took Mum out hawking later on. There was at one point where Henry, I think it was 1176, Henry was actively seeking to divorce her and suggested that she might like to become a nun at Fontevraud. But the interesting thing is that the convent at Amesbury was in need of an abbess, and Amesbury was a Fontevraud daughter house.
Oh, right.
So he could have been looking at her to become the new abbess of Amesbury. Yeah. So I think he was hoping that she'd agree, and she refused. And so it never came about. Who was he hoping to marry in her stead? Who knows? It wasn't Rosamond de Clifford, certainly.
Right.
Because, you know, he's a king. He's got to have somebody a bit more important than...
When does Rosamond Clifford appear?
Not till 1173, I don't think, Gerald of Wales. People tend to say the affair began in 1166 when he was in the Welsh Marches. Nobody knows when they got together.
Hmm.
He might have loved her a lot, but really she was still, in the big scheme of things, a mistress and a baronial nobody.
Yeah.
So it's not somebody that he's suddenly going to put a wedding ring on.
What's your view on what he became during that period?
I think he was awful.
Yeah.
I think he was abusive. I think he was a control freak. Everything had to be under his thumb, and that included Eleanor.
So eventually Eleanor's freed by his death. And what happens? How does she react?
When she got a message, whenever she received the letter of his death, she made a decree freeing prisoners from the various jails around the place, saying she knew how refreshing it was not to be a prisoner. And then she had William Marshall came to see her. He brought letters from Henry.
Right.
So she'd be he was one of the first to greet, which shows again the relationship between Eleanor and the Marshall, that he was one of the first to come to her, and with his new shiny status,
yes.
I've been given an heiress. I'm off going to get married. But there was this, and here are, letters for her from... And then she started immediately, keep getting the country running. She was Richard's surrogate while he was still abroad.
So do you think now she begins to have the kind of...
I think so.
Something approaching the influence that...
I think so, absolutely.
How does that work? Is she made formally regent? Is it this soft power and influence?
I don't think she was made formally regent, but she was, like, given letters of... letters of proof, if you like. Mum's in charge till I get here, but so and so will help her, and so and so will help her, and if she asks you for this, then give it. And so it's informally formal, which sounds like a contradiction,
yeah,
but it's not mum's wearing the crown. It's mum's in charge till I arrive, like the justice ER. And this was how it was set up when Richard went prepared to go on crusade. She was left with authority and various things to do and get on with. And although, of course, she left the country shortly after the start, after Richard, to go and fetch his bride.
Right.
So, of course, other people were ruling the country in her absence. But when there were problems, she had to turn around and come straight back, which suggests that she was sitting at the head of the round table. Mm-hmm. She was chairman of the board.
Right.
But there were other people who could do it while she was away for short periods, or short, long periods.
When Richard's taken prisoner, doesn't she write some letters to the Pope?
She supposedly wrote some letters to the Pope, yes. Certainly under her authority, these letters were written. Whether they ever got the Pope, we don't know.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, nobody knows, actually. There was a cleric called Peter of Blois, who was very, very eloquent. And the letters exist. You can find them online. There's a particular website which has got noble women's letters on, including Eleanor's. And Peter of Blois' letters in Eleanor's voice, or in Peter of Blois' voice, but, dictated to whatever, are on there. And you really have to make up your own mind. Mm. Some people say they're completely written by Peter of Blois. Some say that it's, he's perhaps had his wax notebook out taking notes and that Eleanor's dictated. Who knows?
Right.
But they're there,
supposedly
from Eleanor, and they're very, very passionate.
Yeah. And then Richard, of course, dies, and her other son becomes king. What was her relationship like with John? Did she have the same level of influence under John?
Yes, I think so. And I think that people say she hated John. Don't know what they're talking about. You find that John was being very naughty when Richard was away and rebelling. Mm. At one point, he was being besieged at Windsor, and then suddenly everybody pulls back. Why do they pull back? Because Eleanor tells them to pull back. I mean, she needs to keep the country on an even keel. But if you've got a son who is basically heir to the throne, you're not going to have him taken by your barons, because that weakens him. She can't have the son who's the heir to the throne being weakened. And so in John's interest, she would tell them to pull back. When Richard gets home, she mediates between Richard and John, so they come to an alliance. When John comes to the throne, she mediates with the French for him. She goes and fetches her niece, Castile, to come back and be a French queen, which is part of a peace treaty. She's constantly working, and it's all to do with helping to facilitate John. Whether she may have had a preference for Richard, but at the same time, she never does anything to harm John.
The picture you're painting is of an Eleanor...
who's quite mature decision-making, who is a conservative force, as it were, rather than a disruptive force.
Yes, I think so. She is a stateswoman and a woman who bides her time. Mm. And she also has enormous emotional resilience. Mm. You know, of her children, I think she'd only got... When she died, I think there were two living out of all her children. There were only two who survived her. Of those children, one had, Richard the Lionheart, had died in her arms of gangrene. Her daughter Joanna had died in her arms in childbirth. She had to come back from those and deal with political situations. She's got tremendous, tremendous emotional resilience. Mm. And also I've talked about William Marshall's humanity and diplomacy, and they were good friends. Mm. And that makes sense that she would have had similar mindsets.
Right. Okay, so Eleanor finally dies in 1204, I think.
Yes, I would say... that she is probably responsible for designing those effigies at Pontagol. Bearing in mind that these effigies were lost and shoved in a cupboard for ages and then repainted, so they're not even sure exactly who is who. The one that's purported to be Henry is clean-shaven, and Richard has a beard. So that's always made me interested, because a beard equals, in the medieval period, gravitas and head of dynasty and things. So are we looking at the effigies the wrong way round, or did...
Did Eleanor give
Richard a beard to put just be a subtle comment?
Just a little subtle bit of one-upmanship.
Yes, because when Gerald of Wales draws Henry, he's carved it. It's bearded.
He's got a beard.
Yeah,
that's very interesting. So maybe there was that little suggestion. That
yes, I have no idea. It's a complete theory, but I do find it fascinating, and it's also interesting that she is reading a book, because you know she's the keeper of knowledge. The men are passive. They're just lying there with their staffs in their hands and their swords are off at their sides. And here's mum and wife reading a book. Yeah. Probably a psalter or a prayer book it will be. But she is reading it. Possibly, being as reading was meant to be read aloud in those days, they have to listen to her for eternity.
Interesting. That's a nice thought. Brilliant. Thank you so much. I did want to ask you a couple of general questions. Mm-hmm. So you must have read, you know, God knows how many history books. Give me a couple of your favourite ones that you'd recommend. In any period, doesn't need to be
done. Definitely Robert Bartlett's England and the Norman Angevin Kings, because it's a great big thick book, but it's written in a very readable style and it will cover everything you want to know. If you want to study the period, or if you're a writer like me and you get marooned on a desert island and you've got to write a novel and you can only take one book with you, you take that and it'll have everything in Bracey. You need to know everything. The other one is pretty personal to me, but it's David Crouch's biography of William Marshall in its third edition, because it's got a lot of new material in it about William that nobody else has written about. And it is the gold standard.
What are the new things about David's interpretation?
Well, there's a lot more on tournaments than there were in the other editions. There's an interesting thing that William may have had an illegitimate son.
I was going to ask.
I'm not convinced.
Okay.
But this Gilbert Marshall turns up with various bits of land, and he's definitely a family member, if not a son. So there are new people arriving. And there's also another piece about his father, where as soon as William is married, he has a big mass said for his father, the anniversary of his father's death. So we find out, his father's death date, which nobody knew before, but B, the fact that he had enough of respect for his father, even after the whole hanging incident, to have a mass and feast for him.
Yeah.
The moment he could afford to do something big enough.
Yeah.
And that's when William is a middle-aged man.
Great, that's really good. Thank you very much.
Right, a pleasure. Thank you for doing the interview.
Great.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Good luck. And I hope to be back in a few weeks' time to restart the story of the Tudors.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.